In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 332. I'm very glad today to welcome to the show Toby Baxendale. That's a name that may be unfamiliar to some American libertarians, but I bet at the end of our conversation, you'll say, how did I not know about the outstanding Toby Baxendale? Well, Toby is an accomplished entrepreneur. He's been involved in numerous successful businesses. For example, he built up the UK's largest fresh fish supplier to the food service sector, but he's also a great benefactor of the Liberty Movement. He co-founded the Cobden Center, which we'll talk about in a minute, and he established and funded the first Distinguished Hayek Visiting Teaching Fellowship Program at the London School of Economics. So I'm going to turn right now to my conversation with Toby, but remind you guys, as I did yesterday, that when I recorded this particular conversation and yesterday's, unfortunately I had a hot mic. And that with this temporary jerry-built structure I'm using for a few more days, I couldn't tell I had a hot mic until it was too late. So this will be fixed as of tomorrow, so you won't have to listen to me sounding like an AM radio host any longer starting tomorrow. So I apologize for that. And then on the other side of this conversation with Toby, I'll fill you in on a couple of quick things. So hope you enjoy my conversation with Toby Baxendale. Toby Baxendale, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Thomas. It's a pleasure to be here.
I don't have enough Europeans on the show, so you are helping me little by little rectify that. I think you and I may have met briefly back at the Mises Institute some years ago. You came and spoke there, and I was recently on your personal website, and you've got such a great story of intellectual evolution, how you came to this conclusion, how you came to that conclusion, how you were exposed to this thinker or that thinker. And I think it's interesting and encouraging, and it makes people feel more confident about the future when they hear these stories of smart people like you, entrepreneurial people who come into contact with these ideas, who love them, who promote them. And in fact, you started, you're not just a businessman, but you also started an organization called the Cobden Center. Can you first tell us about Richard Cobden, because some Americans may not know the name, and then secondly about the Cobden Center?
Yes, well, it'd be a great pleasure to tell you about that. Well, Richard Cobden is someone I hope your audience will look up. I mean, he was what we call a liberal, and I know that doesn't translate well in America, but a proper liberal in the sense that you might term a libertarian nowadays in America. We still use the word here to mean, you know, a free market, anti-crony capitalist, anti-war, unilateral free trader, and he was an entrepreneur in the early days of the cotton trade in Manchester, and incensed by the bread taxes, the food taxes that the aristocrats had. Who controlled, you know, all the principal farmland were imposing upon the people, gouging, you know, money off them in a monopolistic way. He was so incensed by that motivated him to get into politics, and quite single-handedly, single-handedly, his persona and that of one or two other individuals. John Bright is another one. That you should, your audience, I hope, will look up as well, led to the abolition of the Corn Laws, which were these very, very monopolistic taxes upon the British people. And that was a revolution, and it was an anti-crony capitalist revolution, and it was a revolution for free. It was a revolution for free trade, for farmers and landowners to be able to produce things, goods and services, for the price that they demand, the fair price that they demanded in a free market situation. But then he moved on to attack trading privileges, and ultimately he I think you could claim that he was one of the most significant factors in the Industrial Revolution for establishing universal free trade, which allowed the British Empire, as it then was — we can, you know, debate whether that was good or bad, but fundamentally it was a trade-driven empire, and it was the golden age of this country, based on unilateral free trade. And then, you know, obviously at his demise, and towards the end of the 1800s, the corporatist interests have then got back on top of the game there, and then kind of closed down the free trade. But he did a very famous act in 1860, which established unilateral free trade across the whole empire. And your man, another man that your audience, I'm sure, will be very well aware of, is Bastiat, and the two of them were collaborators. During the mid 1800s, so that's why. To cut the long story short, is I chose the name Richard Cobden rather than someone like Mises or Hayek, although Hayek has some purchase in this country because he was here for such a long period in time. But it has much more resonance with a UK and indeed a European audience to really express our principal ideas. And I think also from Steve, who is a Conservative Party MP for High Wycombe, the name of Richard Cobden is not owned by any political party in particular, because none of them — and I'm sure I believe it's the same in America, you know, the labels have all kind of lost their routings. So what is liberal and what is conservative now is not necessarily what it was in those days. So Richard Cobden stands astride these party political boundaries. So it gives a good, it's a good name to resurrect and to promote our cause from.
What's the website for the Cobden Center? What's the name?
The Cobden Center, .org.uk.
And it's Cobden Center, of course, spelled with the British spelling, C-E-N-T-R-E?
Yes.
Okay, so I'll definitely link people to that on the show notes page. What I want to talk to you about is your own, intellectual evolution. You've got a little item or a series of items here in your biography about the trade union movement as it existed in the 1970s and 80s. And, of course, we know that Margaret Thatcher did battle with the trade unions, but we don't know, as Americans anyway, what the circumstances really were like. What were the trade unions really up to? What was so wrong with what they were doing? Can you paint that picture for us?
Yes. Well, in general, I'll just make this a very, very wise point. You know, I don't have any problem with workers organizing themselves to represent themselves to their employers in the most favorable light whatsoever. And, you know, the start of the trade union movement in this country had many, many good attributes to it. Where it's gone wrong is where brutality, coercion, monopolistic and closed shop practices have come to the fore. And they've moved away from being, good representatives of their members, good providers of mutual services, insurance, health services. Believe it or not, they're still very, very big private sector health contractors. But you know, they've kind of lost sight of their origins. But you know, fast forward to the 1970s, when I was a child, you know, my first memory of the trade unions is 72 or 73, when they moved to a 3-day week. So literally, you know, they instructed the country to work 3 days a week. And I remember sitting in my primary school and suddenly the lights going out and being sent home to work. So it's very disruptive, completely randomly innocent members of the public who then got caught up with muscling approach by the trade unions, and very aggressive approach. So in the 1970s, you saw literally one trade union boss in one industry could, if he had a grievance with his employers, like the car industry, he could call out the whole of the steel, the whole of the coal, the whole of the teachers, the whole of the you name it industries to come out and strike in unison with him, even when the other parties had no grievances with their employers. And there was a very famous election here in 1974 where Ted Heath, the Tory leader and current Prime Minister, went to the country saying, "Who governs Britain?" Yeah, that was his, is it the politicians or is it the trade unions? And the Labour Party were representing the trade unions. And then lo and behold, they got elected into power because it was the trade unions who were governing Britain. And he was booted out, but they got very, very aggressive and very, very destructive to the extent that I remember another thing towards the late 1970s. I remember seeing rubbish and dead bodies in the street. Yeah. Now, can you believe that in a Western, in a modern Western state, the first industrial state where you have mounds, not just sort of a rubbish bag. I'm talking about whole squares and whole streets blocked up, and the morgues not burying people. And that was the state in around 1978. And that was probably one of the trigger points that led to the rise of Margaret Thatcher in 79. So you had to decide really at that point in time, do you think what the trade unions are doing is right and correct, or do you disagree with what they're doing? And I vehemently disagreed, and was very supportive as a in my young adolescence of Margaret Thatcher taking on the trade unions, because they're Tom, this is a point that you will understand very well. Monopoly practice, be it by the medical sector, be it by a trade union, or be it by an oligarch, or be it by a bank, yeah, it's all utterly, utterly immoral and should be stood against. And I make no distinction between their bad practices and the bad practices of modern day bankers.
Well, I find it very interesting, looking at your biography, that as a young man, you had an opportunity to meet and talk with people who had lived in totalitarian societies, and this apparently stimulated further interest in liberalism in the European sense. And then also, I am struck by what I think is the most radical sentence in this piece you have. It's this one. You say, "No one, including Thatcher, was prepared to attack the five pillars of Soviet-style provision left in our country: education, the National Health Service, the supply of money, the provision of defense, and the judicial process. These great institutions smacked of monopoly privilege and guild-like practices." You are not the ordinary entrepreneur that people might interview.
Yeah. Well, I still stand by that. To a certain extent, you know, a lot of that is idealistic. But, you know, peace is idealistic. And, you know, I would stand in favor of promoting peace wherever we possibly can. And that's a good thing. And I stand against any type of monopoly privilege. And, you know, some of those, I mean, education is one that's breaking down here. We do have a world class private sector education system here. And that has always held its own, but it's led to, and this is the good thing, and surprisingly, under a Labour government of all governments, the last one, the institution of the academy programmes, whereby they're still state funded, but they're getting the private sector very much involved in education provision or opportunities for education provision, and getting entrepreneurs and other and inspirational leaders to start running schools. So it's nipping away at the edges there. So, you know, there are battles we're going to be fighting for, you know, multi-generation, but I never give up hope, because you can still make progress in these areas.
I'm noting here that you studied at the London School of Economics, and I know there's a Hayek lecture series over at the London School of Economics, and I think that has colored American libertarians' perception of the LSE as being maybe a vaguely free market institution. But what you're describing here are economics courses in which you were told that government spending produces a multiplier effect. In other words, completely conventional economics, Keynesian economics. This is what you learned, and apparently you were not convinced.
Yes, that's right. Well, look, let's get a few things into perspective here. So when I was 16 years old, I was standing outside the Polish Centre in Hammersmith, where I was brought up in London. And this centre, we have a big Polish community here in London. At that time, a lot of these guys were still Second World War veterans. So totalitarianism and them, there was no love lost. And an old elderly gentleman took me in there and then introduced me to Hayek. And it was like, wow, you know, this guy, I want to know more about him. And that's when I told my mother, Mum, I'm going to go to the LSE. That's where Hayek was. And then I turn up at the LSE and, you know, as an 18-year-old, got accepted, etc. And to my horror, in the economics department, no one knows anything about Hayek. I mean, literally, no one knows anything about Hayek at all. When you dig around a little bit more, you could study Hayek in the politics and the government department, where you do kind of his Road to Serfdom onwards type work, which of course was his political science work. So fair enough. You can in that department get a good dose of Hayek, and you can get a good dose of, you know, other classical liberal writers as well. But the economics department was hopelessly lost, in my humble opinion, and it was the normal Keynesian versus monetarist type of claptrap. And you know, I'm just not. Call me old-fashioned, I'm just not convinced that government multipliers work, and I wasn't convinced on the circular flow of income, because if that was all that was the case, that's the very first thing you learn, the circular flow of income, then, you know, all we need to be doing is putting more money at the bottom there, and hey presto, we can cure world poverty overnight. And it was just too Alice in Wonderland for me. So I managed to move as many economic options, I managed to sort of get rid of them, still staying in the economics department, but focusing it as much as possible over to the politics and the law department. But the Hayek lecture is something that I established. So that's why that's there. And in fairness to the LSE now, you know, in the economics department, they do recognize him as one of their 9 Nobel laureates. And they do encourage teaching in that tradition.
But that's good.
Yeah, but Tom, it's not in the undergraduate. It's only when you get to the, you know, the dizzy heights of postgraduate work, because the undergraduate's course is still very, you know, absolutely, you know, bog standard mathematical. So if you're you know, a 17, 18-year-old in America looking to come and study at the LSE, you will not be accepted unless you have an absolutely A-star or whatever the equivalent is in America qualification in maths before you come over. So that's just the way – that is the way it is over in that department.
Well, two other things I'd like to ask you. Were you ever tempted to go into academia? And secondly, given that you became an entrepreneur – is there any way that your understanding of the way the world works that you get from thinkers like Hayek and Mises influences you as an entrepreneur, or are these two separate things?
Oh, no. They're absolutely connected. And whenever I do get asked to come in and speak at schools and at universities, I do say, you know, excuse me, really, people should pick up books by Mises and Hayek, and, you know, particularly Israel Kirzner as well, and Peter Klein, because they quite nicely summarise the role of the entrepreneur, which is essentially the manipulator of those factors of production, land, labour, and capital, to make them do something more relevant and more focused in a more efficient way over a period of time for the consumer. That is all the entrepreneur is doing. And that, and those guys, in varying different degrees, sum that up beautifully. We're managers of uncertainty. All I do in any of the businesses that I'm invested in is just focus people on what does that consumer want? How can we get them a better product for less money or a better service, or in some way serve it up to them in a more convenient format than the next man? And it's a constant process. It's a constant process of evolution. And believe you me, and this is the sad thing about the state of economics, is that these are the only guys who you will ever hear speaking constructively about the entrepreneur. Otherwise, you know, the factors of production are all just meant to come together, a bit like the mystery of the virgin birth. You know, it's just a mystery, you know, in the economics department as to why these things happen. That's the sorry state that we're in today. But I do focus people onto what those great Austrians that we so much admire say about entrepreneurship, and they are the only ones who understand it, in my humble opinion.
Well, Toby, I hope I don't embarrass you if I say that one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, in addition to your interesting story, is that I consider you to be a great model of what an entrepreneur can do in terms both of the marketplace and satisfying consumer demand, but also as a benefactor of this great Austro-libertarian movement around the world. I mean, you are an example of someone who walks the walk and talks the talk and does everything that one person can do. You produce value for consumers, and then you take some of your earnings and you turn it around and plow it into the world of ideas. I mean, we can't ask you for more than what you've done already. I'm going to link people to tobybaxendale.com to find out more about you, cobdencenter.org, center spelled in the British way, of course, and I hope we can talk again sometime. Thanks so much for your time today.
Tom, it's a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right, everybody, let's talk about what's coming up tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to talk about the subject, would there really have been no internet without the government? We get that all the time. You stupid libertarians, why don't you understand that this institution, the state, that you spend all your time criticizing, well, for heaven's sake, it gave us the internet, this wonderful revolutionary tool that we all love and use. You stupid libertarians. So we're going to talk about that issue tomorrow and try and get to the bottom of that. Then two other things. Remember that the show notes page for today is tomwoods.com/332. And on that page is a link to my brand new free ebook, 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered. You can click there and find it, or you can just go to tomwoods.com, and right at the top you'll see an offer for a free ebook. That's the one. And it's a full-length book. So I think you guys will like it. It'll help make you better debaters. It'll give you a lot of ammunition that you need when you're out there having these debates. So I hope you enjoy that free ebook. And if you're enjoying this show, I give away a ton of stuff. I challenge any show anywhere to show me that they give away as much stuff as I do to people who support this show. Because if you support this show, basically, I love you. Like, I don't know what else to say. I love you guys who help support the show. Of course, I love anybody who listens to the show. It makes me happy, too. But over at supportinglisteners.com or on any of my show notes pages, you'll see a big thing about being a supporting listener, and there's a big bag of Tom Woods bag of goodies. That Tom Woods bag of goodies is just going to keep growing and growing and growing. But right now, wait till you see all the stuff that's there for you guys who support the show. Not only Liberty Classroom discounts or lifetime Liberty Classroom subscriptions, but also books and the hundreds of videos that I've been making for the Ron Paul Homeschool Program, special discounts all over the place, transcripts of all the interviews, and much more. So warm my heart by heading over to supportinglisteners.com if you feel the show is giving you value. All right, tomorrow it's the internet and the state. You're not going to want to miss that. So if you have not subscribed on iTunes or Stitcher, you are going to be so sad when years from now you realize you forgot to listen to the internet episode. So head over to TomWoods.com and subscribe to the show on iTunes or Stitcher, and we'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.